Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the second installment of Spotlight on Youth this week. My name is Lauren Litton, and I am the host of the radio show that is dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The radio show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate in the show by asking questions. To do so, dial 347-994-1149. That's 347-991-1149. And once you are connected, press number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you're going to be placed in the queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. Joining us today are Lisa Thoreau and Dr. Jeff Bostick from Strategies for Youth, an organization dedicated to improving the interactions between police and youth by increasing the approach, options, and responses of police to youth. Lisa is the director of Strategies for Youth. Before this position, she wore many hats, including working as a researcher and advocate for reform and improvement of the public education system in New York City, and serving as managing director of the Juvenile Justice Center at Suffolk Law School. At the center, Lisa focused on public policy advocacy on behalf of court-involved teens. She monitored juvenile civil rights issues regarding police treatment, tracked trends in those cases, and monitored and challenged legislation affecting youth. Lisa is a graduate of Barnard College, holds a master's in anthropology from Columbia, and a Juris Doctorate from Benjamin and Cardozo School of Law of Yeshiva University. Jeff is the director of the school psychiatry program for children and adolescent psychiatry at the Massachusetts General Hospital. He has also served as medical director of the Massachusetts Child Psychiatry Access Project, in which psychiatrists were on call to assist pediatricians. Jeff helped found schoolpsychiatry.org, a website created to advance service collaboration among clinicians, educators, and families for recognizing and working with children with behavioral and mental health issues in schools. He serves as a training psychiatrist for the Police Training Initiatives and Strategies for Youth, and he holds a medical degree from the Texas University School of Medicine. I want to welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you.
You know, when I think about this issue, unless something really goes wrong, police and youth interaction is something that is not often discussed publicly, but it is very important. Why did the two of you decide to focus on this issue?
Well, thank you for having us on the show, Lauren, and for recognizing how important this issue is. What we realized was that while stakeholders in the juvenile justice community were recognizing that youth development has been clearly established now by science to require special treatment and special reactions, we noticed that a lot of these views were not being transferred over to the policing world. And the use of adult approaches with kids was both harmful to the kids, frustrating to the officers, and not doing communities justice. It wasn't ensuring and increasing good outcomes for kids, increasing public safety. And frankly, our juvenile justice systems are really not equipped or resourced sufficiently to help kids. So we said, maybe if we, instead of stop fishing kids out of the downstream portion of the river, we stop pushing them in at the upstream, we can affect some changes by working with police. And reform groups have really ignored police in this juvenile justice advocacy world. So we said, you know what, let's see if we can share with them some of the things that science is equipping us to understand youth with and make their lives easier and improve their interactions with youth.
And Lauren, just to amplify that, you know, what you mentioned is quite accurate, which is oftentimes it's an incident, you know, a bad outcome, some negative thing in the press, if you will, that stimulates interest. But the moment that anything like that happens, you find as soon as you start talking to both the police officers and to the youth in that area, that both sides are like, they're mindful of the issue and they both want to do things so that they can frankly get along better. Nobody wants to walk around on eggshells. The kids oftentimes feel, you know, distrust, and that's been cultivated by various things. But the officers, too, they don't like living, you know, looking over their shoulders, so to speak. So to my surprise, my experience has been whenever Lisa and I have gone in and worked with police departments in a variety of places, pretty quickly they're eager to do things that are going to make everybody, meaning theirs and the kids' lives, better. We don't usually find a lot of resistance once we get past the front door. Although that being said, I have to say a part of that is because Lisa goes through and literally talks to people in the community, including the kids specifically, and gets usually very savvy about just cultural nuances that vary within given communities that sometimes make it harder for police officers to understand what a kid's given reaction might represent that, you know, is misinterpreted, and vice versa.
I think also you're going to see increasing focus on this because we have more and more police in the public schools. At last count, there were over 17,000 in one estimate from 2007. It's probably higher now, although with the recession, who knows. But you also see the American public calling the police and making police the first responder to issues dealing with youth for a variety of reasons. And if police, who have to deal with children in extreme situations, be they abuse and neglect, victimization, witnessing domestic violence, witnessing community violence, children and youth are not a group that the police have been trained to deal with. And every other professional who deals with children and youth has to go through extensive training to deal with them effectively. We're hobbling police's ability to have really good and effective outcomes, and they understand that, and they want this training to really improve these outcomes and make their lives easier.
Well, it sounds like, you know, you're starting to already, both of you, talk about some of the complexities in this. So how much training do the officers receive on working with children and youth and juvenile justice issues?
Well, typically in most states, the Police Officer Standards and Training Organizations and the national group, which is the International Association of Directors of Law Enforcement and Standards and Training, don't have a minimum on how much officers should know about, let's say, juvenile justice. So in my experience, most academies give 2 hours worth of training, and there's no ongoing in-service training for officers. And there's a lot more about CPR for an infant's body than there is for communication with a teenager. So that kind of imbalance is what we're trying to redress, and that's what our training attempts to do.
Well, stepping back a little bit, you know, Jeff, you had sort of mentioned about, you know, different cultural aspects, and as our country has rapidly changed, and you said that people are relying on the police. I remember, you know, looking back, when you think about 40, 50 years, people thought about police differently. So I want to know, historically, if there's been a change in which communities and youth interact and view the police.
I'm not sure, you know, how much that would vary across the country, but, you know, I think the general trend across the United States is people have become much more migratory. And as that happens, people know each other less well. So I think that variable alone has accounted for lots of differences. And you also see specifically, and we saw this when in some of the work that we've done in some of the specific communities in Massachusetts, that there would be an influx of one, if you will, ethnic group or group of diversity that was just unfamiliar to the officers, and they were trying to, you know, understand them and make sense of their customs, and there would be language barriers and everything else, and that was just difficult for everybody. So the migratory thing that all Americans do now with job mobility and changes and all that, I think has been one, you know, one thing. And then another thing, of course, is just that people don't necessarily know their neighbors in the way that they did, as you said, 40, 50 years ago. We live in an age with hundreds of TV channels, and people can easily stay occupied or preoccupied in their house without really knowing people very well beyond virtually. And for that reason, too, it's harder for people oftentimes to have the same sense of community and therefore trust. That's the ultimate variable that matters that they sometimes did in some of the communities in the past.
The other thing is, I think they're police in a lot more places. I mean, there have always been police on the streets, but we're inviting police more and more into our homes to deal with domestic issues, and we're having more and more police in the public schools at exactly the time when you're having two conflicting currents going on. Even as we recognize that kids are different, and the science is proving it, and the Supreme Court recognizes it, our public policy domain, mainly state legislatures, is saying, you know, we've got to criminalize more of this behavior. And we're putting police in a very difficult position, in our view, because we're saying, you know what, it may be normative, but we want you to punish it. And the police have to walk this funny line between what the legislatures and the communities say they want and this recognition of other parts of our culture, like the courts and science, that that's not effective, it's not going to help kids, and it's actually harmful. So it's a tricky time to be a police officer, and that's because of these huge cultural changes over the last 40 and 50 years.
And you mentioned schools. What are some of the first places of contact for police and youth?
Jeff, why don't you, since you're in the schools.
Well, are you saying what are some of the first places of contact within schools? Or do you mean just
schools is one of them that we're hearing a lot more. Are there other places that when you've been training around the country, where are police and youth coming into contact?
Well, definitely the schools. I'm sorry. But we're also seeing it, you know, in transit situations where you have large groups of people who the police can't all possibly know. Any instance, usually in large cities or transit issues, where there's great anonymity, that means there's less trust and less accountability. But it's also when there's any, we see it tremendously, and this is what upsets officers a lot, when there's just that initial encounter when a kid is told not to do something. And this triggers, in a lot of American youth today, responses that the police find unacceptable.
And what has become controversial or common about these interactions? And this may be where you really do want to talk about the school, because there's been a lot of focus on kids directly getting, you know, the zero tolerance policies in schools and the police interaction there that the schools are turning to them, and then what's happening with these youth.
Well, that's a really big and broad but very important topic. And so let me get a couple of pieces of that. You know, the whole notion of zero tolerance is well-intended, as are many things, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily play out in the way that you would wish for them to. And the point here is that you can really not have zero tolerance for, if you will, violence or bullying or anything else, because human interaction is characterized by sometimes having conflict. I mean, I'll bet you that you've certainly had experiences in your life where you've had, at minimum, conflict, and I'll even bet you, Lauren, you've had times when you'd say you felt like you were bullied, as was I, as was Lisa, and as were most people, including police officers. So the point is that you can't eliminate those things altogether. It's kind of like it reminds me of the let's just say no kind of drug abuse kind of effort some years ago as well. So the point is that you have to be mindful of what are you going to do when those things happen. So I think what's happened is, like Lisa had mentioned, there's an effort here to kind of criminalize what is kind of like a spectrum of behavior, and you have young people who are trying to figure out their identity. I mean, the whole focus really, or a big piece of the focus that we do, is helping officers understand that adolescents are not just smaller human beings than full-grown adults. Their brains work fundamentally differently. And concretely, if you think this through, I mean, it's really obvious. The reality is that when teenagers, kind of reach that stage of being full-fledged teenagers, their job is to pick fights with their parents and to find where they're going to fit in their peer group. And really, thank God this is coded into their DNA, because think this through. If they did not do that, there'd be no reason for them ever to leave home. They would just stay with you until you were like 65 if you were the parent. You'd be like going to work, and they'd say, can you pick up Cheetos and Cokes on the way, you know, back or whatever. So it's actually a very normative thing, but the point is, when kids separate from their parents, they've got to figure out their identity, and they try on all different kinds of roles. Sometimes they're too aggressive. Sometimes they're too meek. Sometimes they're too flashy. Sometimes they're too drab and boring. They try to figure out where they're going to fit, so it's a very confusing time for them. Now, if that's not bad enough, that they're very confused about who they are and they don't know what's appropriate behavior, and therefore they will say to a police officer or a school guidance counselor or a school principal or teacher that, you know, they'll say all kind of things that they would never say to other people because they just don't think it through very well, and they'll say it because their job is to not betray their peers. They'll, you know, stand up and be loyal. If you think back to the old Breakfast Club movie, you know, they show basically five or six kids that are like completely in different cliques, but the moment the adult shows up, they band together after literally fighting amongst themselves until that moment. It's the same thing with teenagers if they do that. And then making all that worse is the fact that we now have brain research that shows us what we've probably already you know, figured out, you know, kind of like obviously over literally centuries, which is kids think differently. And concretely, the brain research from Deborah Yergeland Todd, who was in at McLean Hospital in Boston, but is now at the University of Utah Medical School, and then subsequently was replicated by Jay Geed at the NIMH, it showed that kids, if they're shown a picture, will filter that picture in terms of the part of the brain that, that looks at it first is the deep part of the brain, the amygdala, the emotional center. Parents shown that same picture or adults shown that same picture use the frontal lobe of their brain, the logical part. So literally when police officers or teachers or anybody are saying things to kids like, you know, can you move over here, the kid filters that through this emotional center and hears different things about like, you know, you don't think I know that I could get run over if I move over here or whatever else. That's why you're making me do this. And it encroaches on their, you know, feelings or fears of dependence and independence. So the point is parents and adults are basically speaking French in terms of what their brain's doing in terms of processing information while the kids are speaking, you know, a different language altogether. So it's very difficult for communication to occur there and be what one would think it would be. And so it's a key thing for officers as well as, you know, teachers and people as well to understand that so that they recognize the kids are not being personal when they say what would seem to be like goofy, stupid kinds of things to them with no mindfulness about, you know, the consequences of it.
And I think in cities, the other kinds of points of contact can be for things like searches and pat frisks and orders to deal with basic public order things like move out of the way or be charged with trespass or be charged with the disorderly conduct. And youth will often feel this as a very oppressive behavior by an officer who makes no effort to first have some kind of conversation with them and explain the purpose or the reason they're being told this. And you're going to see more of this because we have, as a culture said, we don't want kids in malls. We don't want hanging them out in public. We don't want them in parks. We don't want them after school unless they're in an activity. We don't want public schools to have them hanging out. They can't really exist anywhere. So these collection of factors leads to a lot of defiant retorts from kids. Like, are you doing this to me because I'm black? Are you doing this to me because you hate Latinos? Are you doing this to me because you're a rent-a-cop? And it's the skilled officer who can hear that defiance and talk it through and de-escalate it. But when you look at national statistics, 40% of juvenile arrests are for what I would call contempt of cop charges, which is disorderly conduct and basically defiance. So this leads to the outcome that we have large numbers of kids having a bad interaction with officers. Officers make clear that they've been trained to assert authority and not lose control of the situation. And the way not to lose control, as officers have been trained, is to arrest. And we're pulling kids into the system who don't need to be there. And if the officer took the time to unpack that act of defiance and rethink what they're doing and examine these claims of bias in themselves and with the youth, you wouldn't have these kids in these systems. And these systems are neither resourced nor equipped to deal with most of these kids. In fact, officers, being men, being authoritative, engaging in a conversation, developing a relationship, are much better equipped to deal with kids engaging in this low-level kind of behavior.
Well, I think it would be interesting then now to turn to what are these the components of the training that you do, given that you've just outlined some of the issues and misunderstandings.
Well, Jeff does the most exciting part of it, so I'll just very quickly explain what I do and then turn it over to Jeff. We do an introduction that typically uses the results of our assessments before we do a department training and explains what officers have said to us and what kids have said to us and what community leaders have said to us and go from there. And officers are fascinated by what kids think, and so are we, because it very often mirrors officers' perceptions of the relationship. We discuss the demographics of the particular area to explain how extreme poverty or abuse and neglect will explain certain kinds of behaviors of kids, and that it's important to understand the genesis of some of these behaviors in kids' circumstances, because kids are not free. They are living in a lot of institutions and family situations that aren't the best for them. We then look at some cultural issues that are affecting kids that produce competing messages for officers right now, and then we look at juvenile law for law enforcement, because many police have not had juvenile law updates, and don't know some of the recent social science research showing that the adult approaches to interrogation or Miranda or use of detention that we use with kids are really not appropriate for kids, and there are other approaches that would work better. And then Jeff does the tour de force.
Well, actually, I'll jump in and say that that's totally, of course, false. The reality is that what Lisa does as far as getting the cultural context and the context of the community is invaluable. And we found that the simple act of doing that usually illuminates kind of where the target interventions are to kind of enhance the camaraderie, the fit, the trust, again, if you will, between the kids and the officers in the community. Now, that being said, you know, kind of the big global part is kind of like I alluded to. We go through and we do the brain stuff, which was literally what I told you a few minutes ago, so that officers literally can understand developmental differences between adolescents and grown-ups, so that it's like, again, it's clear to them why they act differently than an intelligent person, yuck, yuck, would act. And so then most importantly, what we're trying to do then is to, if you will, not in any way criticize the officers for what they've been trained to do, but rather just to expand their tool belt, if you will, and that is specifically to give them ways, you know, psychological techniques that they can use to relate to kids or work with them so that they can diffuse and de-escalate situations instead of, you know, hypertrophy, what they're used to using that doesn't work, that only does escalate situations and then oftentimes leads to arrest. So concretely, it's simple things like, you know, watching a young person and getting a handle on what it is that they're doing. And so, again, you know, the thing that drives adolescent aggression is oftentimes, again, loyalty to their friends. It's better to go down fighting for your friend than it is to just work, you know, with someone and then the officer and tell them what's going on so that a solution occurs. So their loyalty to their friends oftentimes supersedes their IQ, if you will, at least in that moment. So getting a bearing on that's kind of first and foremost. And then secondly, after the motives of the adolescent are kind of considered, then they use, again, specific techniques that we kind of illuminate for them. And it's simple stuff like finding the good intention gone awry. You know, concretely looking at what then, you know, again, oh, so it was important for you to, like, defend your bud here. However, by doing that, it looks like, you know, you're both going to get in trouble and neither of you are going to be able to evade going to jail, if you will. And, you know, and then a key thing is many of the officers, you know, kind of presume sometimes that people in their community know how to behave correctly when, in fact, sometimes people are recent to that community or they just have not been habilitated to, you know, and to be appropriate. And so there's no talk of rehabilitation if you've never learned in the first place, like, how to talk to people. And so some kids have grown up yelling and screaming or, you know, lying or doing other kinds of things that are inappropriate, so they've never had better techniques modeled for them. So we try to really help the officers be mindful of modeling appropriate behavior for the kids because many of these kids just don't have optimal circumstances as far as all the adults who are around them. So we try to go through that with the officers about what, again, to, you know, model and show is the rules of their house. Again, kids rarely understand kind of the customs, you know, that are expected of them, you know, in a school or sometimes on the street corner, you know, in an officer's beat. And so defining those rules for them is very important rather than just assuming that they know them and that they're deliberately disobeying them just to get back at you. And then, again, trying to diffuse situations through humor, through connecting to the kids, through talking to them individually. And, again, as much of that stuff that can be done as proactively as possible rather than in the midst of a crisis, obviously we try to do. And that was really the good intention of having school resource officers in the first place, was making a police officer a familiar resource rather than someone to be feared when you've done something wrong. And so similarly, when the officers are available in the community, they're on foot, they know the individuals, that's very helpful. And then the other thing that we do just solely to have fun is we teach the officers how to ask kids completely unrelated questions when the kids are arguing so that it breaks the cycle of conflict that's going on. So literally we teach the officers about asking things like, you know, is it cold or hot in this room, or, you know, how's your mom, or something like that, anything that will just alter a conversation that's destructive and escalating conflict.
The other thing we do, Lauren, which I think is recognized to be really in need and not adequately supported. In fact, yesterday I was talking to a police chief, and he said, you know, we spend 5 times as much training time training police officers what to do with their gun than what we train them to do with their mouths. And it's a great comment. And what Jeff really teaches is how to use your mouth effectively with teens, because we know yelling at them doesn't work. We know that colluding and working with them to appear not to lose face works best. And how does an officer do that without the officer appearing to lose face or control is the nut of the issue here. But the other thing we do, too, is we train kids how to deal with police. And that's through this game called Juvenile Justice Jeopardy. I wanted to add that the other thing Jeff does is focus a lot police recognizing kids with mental health issues, because we know that the vast majority of kids who are incarcerated in America have 2 to 3 DSM diagnosable mental health issues. And if they had been dealt with sooner instead of put into that system, there is a belief that they would have gotten the help needed and not caused the havoc that some of them have caused for lack of mental health support. And one of the things we've noticed in playing this is we made movies and we asked officers, what is this person reflecting or presenting in the way of a mental health issue? And I think the one that most upsets me is they never recognize that a kid that we have portrayed in this movie is presenting PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, most officers in urban America are dealing with kids who have been exposed to some kind of violence just by nature of living in an urban center. For them not to recognize PTSD puts them at a disadvantage, and certainly puts kids at a disadvantage with officers. So that's the kind of thing we do, too. And frankly, in view of the number of calls I get for kids with Asperger's or autism being arrested in public schools, the other film we made showing a kid with Asperger's and officers not recognizing what that mental health issue is equally disturbing. So we try and close some of these gaps and give officers the support and knowledge that can help deal with it. And then on the other end, as I was starting to say, we play this game Juvenile Justice Jeopardy to help kids recognize what their choices are when they deal with officers. If they're going to be defiant, watch out, because these are the repercussions. If they're going to do this and that with their peers, watch out. You might live in a joint venture conspiracy state. Even passive involvement with certain peers can lead to really harmful side effects and collateral consequences in terms of what your record will preclude you from accessing in education, employment, and other things. So we don't just focus on the officers, we also focus on the kids. And whenever we go into a community and do a training with police, we also work in the schools, in the after-school programs, and with juvenile defense attorneys and youth advocates to replicate this game called Juvenile Justice Jeopardy.
Great.
I'm sorry, let me interrupt with one other thing, Lauren, and that is we do the videos of kids with various psychiatric disorders. In fact, we use the same person, the same, if you will, actress in this case, to do all these different kind of like mental illnesses. There's about 5 or 6 different ones. And we do that because 1 in 5 kids has a diagnosable disorder that's really impairing their functioning at any given moment. So in every group of 5 kids that you walk across as an officer, you can assume that 1 of them may have something going on that makes them act more erratic or more irrational than they might otherwise act. And again, I don't mean that in any way to stigmatize people with mental health, but rather to simply say that we want officers just kind of attuned to that, and that's not something that they historically get. And again, we're not doing it because we want to turn them into mental health clinicians, but because we want them to be, as if you will, armed, and I'm using that metaphorically, not literally, with tools to deal with whatever is there, because those are the kids who can really be erratic and really can escalate rapidly because they have other forces that are kind of driving. And so we found that very helpful to have those video vignettes that Lisa alluded to.
Well, I just wanted to remind our listeners that if they had a question they wanted to ask on air, to call 347-994-1149 and press 1 on their keypad. We do have a question in the chat room that says, we have a lot of clients who get criminally charged by resource officers in the schools. We've even had instances of kids being pepper sprayed. How can your model be used with resource officers?
Well, we just did a training of Connecticut school resource officers, we find that when police officers in the schools recognize the special needs of youth, recognize that they cannot use adult techniques either with youth or in a school setting, which has as its first goal education, and recognize that they are just as powerful as teaching adults as they are in enforcing laws, and perhaps more powerful and more likely to be viewed as legitimate and get respect by taking a very paternal instead of a very criminalizing position, that we can have great impacts. We really need to make sure that officers going to the public schools also understand that children with special ed needs should not be punished for manifesting their disabilities. And when I've talked to some school resource officer associations, they beg to differ and feel that special ed populations are just as in need of a rest as any other group, and they don't always accept the special ed designation. One of the things we try and do when we look at the mental health and the developmental issues with officers is question just how effective it's going to be to arrest. Is this really effective? I mean, do you think this will cure the behavioral issue? And try and get them to rethink just the complete reliance on that single tool when we know other things work better.
And I want to amplify another thing here, which is, unfortunately, oftentimes the school resource officers are not perceived as an advocate for the students and someone there who's part of the school community as a regular integral member. Instead, sometimes the school resource officers are perceived as the entity of last resort. So two bad things happen with that. One is that when kids interact with police officers, it's usually around something that's pretty negative, and that's the way that everybody expects that that interaction is going to be or go, because that's historically occurred there. But secondly, when it works in that vertical chain of command like that, like first the assistant principal or the teacher will talk with the kid, and then the kid will get more jacked up and more hostile, and so then they'll have the principal come in, and then they'll have the school officer. The poor school resource officer, you know, he's really walking into a hornet's nest. And so for that reason, it's critically important from my vantage point that from the beginning, the school resource officer is implemented into the entire school structure in such a way that they're not the adversary. Because you got to remember, developmentally, for some kids, they would rather go down in a blaze of glory, being pepper sprayed, if you will, because they don't have any sense that they're actually going to be harmed or die or get killed in this. And they're like, they'll push it to the nth boundary. And it's like, you don't want to be going down that road. That's not good for anyone. We would far rather see kids, as well as all the adults in the school, deal with situations that lead to de-escalation of conflict rather than escalation to where you have to use kind of force.
Well, it's the only
other...
We just
got a round of applause somewhere.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
Jeff has a huge audience. The thing we've written about in a study of police perspectives on their position in schools is a policy brief with the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice called First Do No Harm, and it's a law review article, too, called Controlling Partners in the New York Law School Law Review, in which we show that a lot of principals use police to do a kind of dirty work and get rid of some of the most troublesome kids, and this is how police perceive it. And that in other places where police are proactively used as another set of hands, another adult to build relationships with children, that it is much more effective and you have less need for the police to play a solely enforcement role. But the police were telling us, we know there's certain teachers who can't deal with kids, and then they dump discipline issues onto us when it's really their inability to control a classroom or manage a classroom or manage a school. That's the real root of the problem, not us. But somehow, again, like I mentioned at the beginning, the police get caught in the crossfire and in between these big cultural changes.
So that raises a point, kind of a question for me, is that do you also work with the schools and the community? Because it's one thing to help the officers be better able to understand why youth may be behaving the way they are, to identify if there are some mental health issues or chemical dependency issues, but the community, also, they need resources as well to turn to be have a holistic approach here. So I don't know what your experience is in communities coming and schools coming together when they want to also improve the interaction between youth and police.
I think our greatest accomplishment so far has been in Boston doing that, because the Boston Police, the Boston MBTA Transit Police, recognized that the only way they could deal with the 40,000 kids going to and from school each day and maintain order in a system that's not built for that number of kids, much less that number of commuters, was to partner with community members. And those are school folks, people from the Boston Children and Families and Youth groups, and these are youth workers, as well as probation officers. And together, those people have established relationships with kids. That means that there's this lack of anonymity that occurs typically in such situations, and it's community policing at its best. And they reduced arrest from 646 in 1999 to 74 in 2009 with our training and our intervention and our helping them build these connections. Probably the most exciting thing they did was create something called Truancy Watch. Police in Massachusetts have no legal right to arrest a kid who's truant, but what they did was build this questionnaire, create a questionnaire, and the police and school attendance officers would go out and interview kids about why they were truant. And as a result of this, they said to the Boston Public Schools, what the heck are you doing for all these truant kids? What are you doing for these kids who are suspended or out because they're depressed or out because they're pregnant? What are you doing for them? And the Boston Public Schools didn't really respond initially. And it was the MBTA Transit Police that lobbied ceaselessly, the way all of us education advocates had for years to no effect, but it's the MBTA that forced, I would say, the Boston Public Schools to create a re-engagement center. And the numbers again dropped. So the MBTA, I think, interviewed something like 850 kids 3 years ago, 400 last year, about 400 2 years ago, and about 270 last year. And we're seeing that this kind of connective, educational, showing that we care attitude works very effectively with kids. In fact, when we survey kids, that's what they say they want. They want officers to show they care, that the punishment will be accepted and swallowed if there's a show of care, too. But when the punishment or the interaction focuses on the power imbalance and makes a kid feel ashamed or further denigrated, then all the kid can focus on is not what they've done wrong, but how badly the officer made them feel about it. And then all the attention goes into the officer's style instead of the officer's substance.
And I just want to amplify that decrease from 646 arrests several years ago to I believe it was 74 the subsequent year or 74. That's remained stable. So they had this huge drop kind of after this training. And I don't want to ascribe that solely to us by any stretch of the imagination. There have been a number of people within the MBTA as well as the chief who have been instrumental in not only kind of employing some of the things that we had talked about, but also, again, taking those strategies and, like Lisa said, partnering with other members of the community, and specifically Officer Mark Gillespie has been instrumental in kind of building the MBTA program there so that, again, it's addressed the things here that Lisa has talked about. So what I want to say with that is that officers are perceived sometimes as people who are going out simply enforcing laws. And I got to tell you, the 21st century officers are actually very smart, savvy people, in my experience, who are much more mindful about trying to make the world a better place in a simpler fashion by proactively, setting up systems to avoid circumstances where problems kind of bleed out. So they've been huge in taking stuff and then taking it to the next level.
I invite your listeners to listen to Lieutenant Mark Gillespie talk about his approach and how it's changed historically. He talks about 10 years ago. You can hear him on a video on our website at strategiesforyouth.org. And he talks about kids being defiant and about the different approach to policing. And Truancy Watch and Stopwatch are his brain children. And I think he also illuminates or illustrates just how well, when you give officers some other alternatives and say, go ahead, grow, dream, what would you prefer to do instead of the same old, they come out with these brilliant ideas. They have all the answers. All we do at Strategies for Youth is say these other approaches are really worth listening to, and the hard on crime is not necessarily smart on crime with kids.
Are there other examples that you want to share where the training has really made a difference? And it may be helpful even for our listeners to hear what were some of the impetus for communities to reach out and contact you for training? You know, if they're thinking about, well, I'm not sure if we really have that issue here or we have this, is that enough?
Well, we had two recent cases that are quite different that I thought I'd mention. One resulted from a federal civil rights suit for racial discrimination in one town. And between the assessment reflecting to officers that people felt that racial differences really permeated the police youth interaction, and between officers having to step back and look at their interactions from youth's point of view, we saw a huge difference in the resulting arrest rates and, more than that, the interactions. And we had some really angry officers saying, we don't need this, it's not our problem, it's not our problem, and we don't like what you're saying. I remember one saying to me, but at the end he said, you know what, now when I deal with the kid, I make sure I have my strategies for youth on, because I know if I do, it's going to be easier and it doesn't upset me so much. So that was kind of neat. The other one was, again, we saw a reduction in arrests in a much larger city with over 120,000 people in it, in a different part of Massachusetts. But in addition to our assessment, the police chief decided that no kid would be arrested in a public school by a school resource officer. If there was an arrest in a school, it would only come by another officer because the relationship between the kids and the officers was so important. And this, coupled with the new approach, led to a massive reduction in arrests. For instance, over the summer, there were two arrests of juveniles, which is unheard of in their history. But our assessment also led them to do two other things that was neat, which was align their child abuse and neglect, child welfare, delinquency, and domestic violence programs into one unit, and to work intensively with the psychology and psychiatric unit of the local hospital, and include male psychologists in teams of officers to deal with families that seem to have burgeoning problems and try and get them into services sooner. It was a very unusual approach for that department, and it's worked magnificently, and now the chief often speaks about that. They also commissioned strategies for youth to create a version of Juvenile Justice Jeopardy that would focus on girls because they were seeing increased bullying among girls, and they didn't know quite how to alert girls in a way that girls would understand. So we used that game to explain that to them and some new enactments of law in the state of Massachusetts to make them aware of what kind of behavior was going to put them at risk. And they had us do this with some police officers who explained what police officers would be compelled to do if they saw this behavior. And I can't tell you how often kids will come back to us after a game like Juvenile Justice Jeopardy, or even police officers will come back to us and say, we didn't know. We didn't know that this was happening. We didn't know that this law meant that, or that this would be the side effect. I mean, one of the things we learned from playing Juvenile Justice Jeopardy, which just floors me, is that kids say they don't know they shouldn't touch a police officer. I mean, that just blows me away. How could they not know you should never touch one? I don't know, but they don't. So some of this very elemental, basic information is missing out there, both from police and from kids, and we hear parents missing it too. So we work with advocates. Sometimes we're pulled into a community by an advocacy group, which is cased in a couple of cities across the United States now. Sometimes by police misconduct attorneys who say, please help us get this police department to understand shackling six-year-olds is not a good idea. So it's all over the place. And then we have wonderful police chiefs out there who say, you know what, this is a skill I want my officers to have, and I'm going to deal with this proactively and affirmatively because it's also going to reduce my concern about liability. So it runs the gamut as to how we get pulled in, and the results of our involvement are really exciting afterwards. It's not always what we envisage either.
Well, I promised both of you that we would run 45 minutes, so we really only have 1 or 2 minutes left. And everything you just laid out, I have so many questions because it sounds like it could really translate to other areas of the juvenile justice system, this training as well. with courts and attorneys and things like that. And I would be interested, and probably our listeners would be as well, about have you made that move to that? But I think at this point we're at final thoughts.
Well, I'll end first by saying we are being invited in by different departments of probation, actually, to play the juvenile justice jeopardy game with kids so that they violate probation less. But also we're hoping to give probation officers who follow up on court dispositions the same kind of training to understand erratic behavior among kids. But if anything, my final thought would be to say that I think luck favors the prepared mind, as Louis Pasteur said. And if officers are well prepared, we can help them have the good luck and the excellent skill set to reduce conflicts and reduce putting kids into a system that doesn't always do well by them. And it's these relationships between cops and youth that will make communities safe. Jeff?
I'll just chime in with another thing. Again, we're very excited about this work, but your other point, Lauren, is absolutely dead on the money, which is this is not stuff that's unique just to police officers. I do the same thing in about 20 school districts where I work. It's all the same thing about equipping teachers with different tools to work effectively with kids, too, and as you would imagine, they overlap substantially. And the same thing is, too, throughout the juvenile justice system. You know, what we're really about is translating the most effective findings that we have, both from brain research and other psychological research, to just clarify options for officers, and I'll expand it to adults. That even includes parents, so that they can just be effective with their kids and so that life can go better for all the parties involved here, and that they can navigate kids through sometimes very turbulent kind of times with minimal kind of trouble. Because just as Lisa said at the beginning, we don't find that it usually is to any kid's advantage to find themselves in the juvenile justice system if we can instead equip them with tools so that they can navigate, quote-unquote, real life. And that's really what our objective is about.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to be here today. Perhaps we'll be able to convince you to come back. And I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in. The show will be available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/spotlightonyouth. Up next will be Judy Cox from the Annie Casey Foundation, who will be joining us on Tuesday, December 14th at 3 p.m. Eastern to talk about the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. We have five counties now in Ohio that are implementing JDAI. To stay informed about this and other upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit www.childrenslawky.org. Have a good weekend, and we will see you next time here on Spotlight on Youth.
Thank you, Lauren.